Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
Today's guest is Trey Taylor. Now, I met Trey through a colleague because Trey and I have both published through the same publisher. And so we're going to get to talking about his book today. But what's interesting about Trey is how he entered into the family business, which got started in 1968, and what his career trajectory, where it was going before that. This is a young man who was a 40 under 40 in Georgia, you know, so a top leading business guy. He had a law degree. He is well educated, and he was working in some of the most attractive, like, venture capital space that you could imagine. He is a venture capitalist. He is an entrepreneur, and he is the owner of a family insurance business. Trey, welcome to the show today.
Jonathan, pleased to be with you. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks to our buddy Scott for introducing us.
Yeah. So I probably butchered your bio, but frankly, you know, when someone has so many credentials and so many talents, you kind of have to just cut to the chase and let people know, like, who are we listening to? And, you know, you're the real deal. So you got to work for AOL. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that was the place that I was headed to work before I ended up taking a little bit of a detour and coming into the family business at that point.
Okay, yeah. So I know you have a really great story to tell, so we want to tell that story. But tell us a little bit about your background. So was your father very helpful to you in defining a career? I think at one point you said, son, don't go into this business, go into something else. Like, tell us
exactly
about
right.
that. You know, what was that conversation like at that time?
Yeah. So our family business is 52 years old this year, started by my grandfather. So it's third generation business. Only 9% of businesses, which obviously, you know, make it to the third generation of the founder's family. So, you know, that's quite a point of pride for us. And we're working on the fourth generation we speak.
That's great.
Yeah, so
congratulations.
We're doing our part there. And so my dad actually bought my grandfather out of the business in the late 90s. And he was very clear to me that, you take what we can give you and go off and find a different life, a broader life, something more sort of in the professional realm rather than the sales realm and that sort of thing. And so, you know, he encouraged me to go to law school. So I did. I went to Tulane Law School, where I sort of really focused and was super fascinated with taxation, how transactions are structured, mergers and acquisition, you know, and was really headed for that sort of corporate law lifestyle. It was right in the middle of the first internet bubble. And so kids were coming out of law school, you know, and you can go work for a firm for $60,000, $80,000, $90,000, or you could go work for somethingsomething.com for $100,000 plus $20 million of stock options.
You know? I mean, so you were like headed, you could have been going to Wall Street with that kind of a background, probably.
Yeah, and that was a little bit. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was a little bit the plan, is to put the bona fides together for a banking career or something of that nature.
Okay.
So. So I ended up getting a clerkship at the company that became WebMD before it was even called WebMD. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated law school, the general counsel said, "You're not going anywhere. You sit right here and you help us out." So I didn't even take the bar immediately. You know, it was very much of you focus on getting these transactions done. And we bought, my first year there, we bought 78 companies.
Wow.
Yeah. And we did the largest private placement of equity in U.S. financial history, a record that still stands today. And we were doing all kinds of, we would do a deal on Tuesday, it'd be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal Wednesday. So it's really heady stuff.
I remember those days because WebMD was a fast rising star in the world of the internet and gathering information on, you know, medical intelligence and serving it up to people. And they're one of the companies that survived, right? They're still business, and there's, I don't know if they're publicly traded, but they're definitely still in business.
Still around, and you know, and is very much one of the success stories from that time, because yes, you almost use it as a verb today. Well, let me WebMD those conditions and find out that I'm going to die, basically, right?
Okay.
Which is what they tend to say, I think, a lot of times. So yeah, I spent a lot of time there and then left WebMD to get into the venture business in Atlanta at that time. And so had a good run there until 9/11 happened, and it just killed the venture market completely. We were in the process of raising our second fund at that point. And there was just no money to be found. And you remember those times of how it's just uncertain, you know, what in the world is happening. And so nobody was writing checks for anything. So I went in-house at a company called Earthlink.
Yeah,
you and I spoke about that.
Yeah, I think they were the dial-up guys.
They were the dial-up guys. And they had merged with a company in Atlanta.
Right.
And the challenge that the company had, Mindspring, yeah. And the challenge the company had was they had no ability to produce innovative products in-house.
Right.
And so my pitch to them was, well, you know, VCs have a lot of investments in companies that they would probably kill to show you. So bring me on and let me run your venture capital relations team, which I did for 2 or 3 years, did some business development negotiations for them as well. And then was approached by a recruiter to join AOL. And AOL had, you know, they had acquired for 10 years, they had been on an acquisition binge. Just all kinds of names that you could, you know, you would know, and you could think of Huffington Post and Netscape and you know, all kinds of things. Sort of, it was the graveyard of once great companies.
Yes.
And, yeah. And they had a new sort of president who had come in and said, we need to get focused on whatever our real business is going to be. And running 800 or 900 companies is, you know, company brands is not that. So they hired me to come in and do divestitures. And the portfolio they gave me was go raise $1 billion by selling off what you can sell off.
Wow.
And so that's the career I was headed for. And then I got a bad phone call.
Well, okay. So let's just pause for a second. What a fascinating story. You like, I mean, I lived through that period and was, I jumped into the internet and saw all these companies, and I invested in a lot of what I call, you know, sock puppet type stocks that, you know, rocketed. And then I recall buying really good quality stocks that went down. So, and then my business that we were involved in went up and went down, and you could have charted our revenues to the NASDAQ's revenues. To the NASDAQ's number. It was just, but you worked for like the really blue chip companies. I mean, the fact that AOL is still around and the fact that some people still have AOL email addresses is kind of laughable to me.
Sure enough, yes.
Right? But but I have friends who still have Earthlink email addresses. Mm-hmm. And you know, and WebMD is certainly a trusted source. So you got to work for these blue chip companies. You were buying and selling. You were in fast track with a law degree. You know, I know I saw you spent some time in Berkeley as well, doing a little certificate program there. So, and then what happened?
So then that phone call came in, and I was literally standing in front of my house. The movers were on the way from Virginia to pick up everything in the house, and so I was sort of out front strategizing where I was going to stage everything. And the phone rang, and it was my mom. And it was the first of the year, around this time of the year. And they had gone to Las Vegas to visit some family that we have that live out there. And, you know, they were going to enjoy the nightlife a bit and have a, you know, blow off some steam before it was time to get back to work. And mom said, your dad is in the hospital. And you know, we're kind of worried about it. And, you know, as you do, you're sort of in the middle of 20 things. And I said, okay, well, you know, definitely keep me up to speed so I know what I have to do. Do I need to meet you at home, or do I need to push back my start date for a couple of days? And, you know, I was just planning the future right there. And she said, no, Trey, you don't understand. You need to be on a plane right now, or you're not going to get to say goodbye. Mm. And, you know, it was like the entire peripheral vision went away, and it was, you know, dark. So I did get out there. My dad actually held on for a couple of weeks, which was a surprise to us and his doctors. And, you know, he really did everything he could to come back from the condition that he had. And unfortunately, he succumbed at the end of that 2-week period on January 31st. And so, you know, we brought him back in the cargo hold of the plane instead of in first class where he belonged.
Right.
And then, you know, he had no succession plan for his business. My brother worked in the business, my younger brother. You know, friends of his worked in the business, but no one was positioned to run the business. And so it was a, you know, it was a nice asset and I didn't want it just to disappear. And so I really had to have a serious conversation with myself as to, you know, what, if any, role is there for me in this business that I wasn't drawn to. Mm-hmm. If I'm being candid with you, I kind of felt a little bit, you know, above it, a little too good for it.
Yeah, of course.
Dad had told me, right, like, don't do this, you know, right, don't do this for a living. And so I had a lot of head trash to get through to make a decision on that.
And yet your brother was in the business, and had he been in the business a long time? I mean, what was
it? Was the only job he ever had.
Wow, what a different career path he took. So, and
he
was,
did, yeah,
was he the, you know, heir apparent, the successor? He certainly wasn't going to be a disruptive successor, doesn't sound like. But
no, he was, you know, really close to my dad. They were very close. They were good friends as well as father, son.
Right, right.
But my brother's gifts and talents were very much in the sales side of things, mm-hmm, and not so much in the administration side of things. Just wasn't what, you know, turned his wheel. And so there was a lot of discussion around, you know, is he able, capable of doing it because of the, you know, the grief that he's going through first and foremost. And then secondly, you know, is it what he wants to spend his day doing?
But you could be very successful in an insurance business if you're really good at sales. I mean, isn't sales sort of the number one skill set you have to have to be good in insurance?
It is. If you're an independent, you know, one or two man shop, we run a pretty big shop.
Right.
And so the management of other salespeople.
Gotcha.
Is a key thing. Yeah.
Understood. Can you tell us what the size of the shop was at that time?
At that time, we had about 35 independent agents in 38 states.
Oh, wow. So that's a very large, like, insurance out, not large, but it is definitely bigger than the typical mom and pop. So for those who are listening and are familiar and thinking, who do I buy insurance from? Most of you are probably buying insurance from a farmer's insurance agent, a State Farm. Maybe you're getting it from your industry association, as many of my clients have in the past. And those shops may only be 35 people. So you're the size of, you know, the equivalent of like a really good industry association insurance type organization.
Yeah. And super niche. So we found what we were good at and we decided that we were going to be the best at it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would laugh because we live in a very small hometown, about 40,000 people is the size of our hometown, Valdosta, Georgia.
Wow.
And people would laugh and say, how on earth are you literally moving the needle on numbers, you know, countrywide? And you're just this little, you know, place in the middle of nowhere. You know?
Right.
So, yeah, that was always a point of pride for us.
So take us through the experience of being there with your brother and sort of maybe having a conversation about, okay, where the leadership of this company is going to come from and, you know, how you're going to interject yourself all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah.
You were a corporate, like, jet flyer. You were like the million miles or 5 million miles club type of thing, and here suddenly now you're settling into a town of 40,000 back into the family business. And
so there was a lot of culture shock and there were a lot of awkward and uncomfortable conversations that had to be established, not only between my brother and I, but the rest of the family. We had we had certain family members that thought that the business should be divvied up between the family members and not, you know, me who had never been there and that kind of thing. That was an uncomfortable conversation and which persisted for quite a while until everything got okay. All of these people, they didn't know me, you know, they were very concerned that maybe I'd come in and sell it off or maybe I'd come in and mess it up. And so we had to have a lot of those conversations. The most awkward conversation was the one that I had to have with myself. And so I recall it February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. I went out of town, went to a hotel and just got a cup of coffee and sort of sat in the chair and had this, you know, debate with myself around, I was starting to get really good at the career that I had chosen for myself, that first sort of arc where I wasn't just doing what people told me to do. I was the one that was going to call the shots on how it was to be done, right? That first arc in the career. Mm-hmm. I had been hotly pursued by AOL that this is the guy for the job that we want. And there was a lot of ego wrapped up in that, of course. And I had to counterbalance all of that with the fact that my dad never told me no. Everything I ever asked him to do for me, he was right there with, I may agree or disagree with this, but you know, if it's money that you need, here's the check. If it's influence that you need, let me make a call. If it's anything that you need at all, let me make it happen for you. So at the end of the day, I said, you know, I always have known, and we sort of are raised and we communicate in these terms that we take care of each other. Of course, families do that.
Sure.
And I always knew that at some point it would be my turn to give back. I just figured it would be when my dad was 80 years old or, you know, something of that nature.
Right.
And but in reality, the time frame wasn't mine to decide, but the obligation was.
Well, that's
and
an
so
interesting thing.
I said, now's the time, you know, that I have to give back. And then I let my brother know that, listen, I think I've got to come in and be the CEO here. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid of what he would think and say about that. You know, I didn't want him thinking I was horning in on his business or, you know, any of that sort of thing. And it was a lot of relief that came over his face when I told him that.
Wow.
I think he knew that it wasn't for him to do that and he was going to be called into that role.
Right.
And the promise that I made him was, I will train you to do what I'm going to do as we go along in partnership together. Because he and I owned it a third, a third, a third with our mother at that point. We eventually bought my mother out, and then I bought my brother out a long term.
Interesting.
Play later. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, is he still involved in the business at all, or he's not?
He's not. So I bought him out a couple of years ago, and then unfortunately, we lost him last year because of some health issues that were quite a surprise to us.
I'm sorry to hear that. So,
very young.
I don't want to touch on too much sensitive ground, but I imagine it was a difficult conversation to be buying him out. And, you know, this is the only job he had ever been in. And, you know, tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I don't mind. 50-50 partnerships are the hardest thing in the world. People, you probably know this, people who are married and believe that marriage is a 50-50 partnership don't get it. It isn't, right?
Right.
And business isn't a 50-50 partnership either. That's just the equity split. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes somebody has to do a lot more than 50%. Sometimes they do a lot less than 50%. And you know, those things can wear on personalities. My brother and I got to that place in our business where I think we both felt that we were unappreciated in the full aspect of what we were doing for the business. And after a couple of sharp interactions, we were great friends. We sat down and said, if we continue to do this, we're going to be one of those families that doesn't speak to each other because of a dollar. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to do that. And so, you know, I made my brother a prisoner's dilemma offer. Like, here's my best offer. You take it mm-hmm. or I'll take it. Whichever one you decide, that's what we're going to do.
Right.
And he came and he said, it was so interesting. He came to my home and we sat in my study, this room. And he sat in that chair right there that you can see in the background. And he said, this is the only thing I've ever done. And I like it, but I don't think I'm in love with it anymore. Do you think you can buy me out? And can you teach me and help me and guide me a little bit on the things that I want to do, which were a lot of real estate investments and commercial development?
Mm-hmm.
And so we papered that transaction pretty quick. He got a sizable check and then another check the year after that. And then he began some very, very solid, very well put together commercial real estate deals. And when he passed, those passed to his trust, which is a part of our family office, which I now run.
Right, right.
So it's full circle.
Okay, yeah, wow. So so he didn't go off and found a family office that you then, you know, joined. You basically started the family office after his passing. So let's fast forward now. Interesting. So today, you have a family office, you invest in real estate, you invest in early stage disruptive technologies.
That's right.
You're a venture partner and you're a limited partner in some venture capital firms doing early stage investing. And you're only working 4 hours a week in the insurance business?
Yeah. So I have a very capable management team in the insurance business.
Right.
And so over the past 2 years, we have been almost over exaggerated in as much of the way that we have delegated to that team the authority and the responsibility to hit the goals. And so we are now working in such a way that we had a blip yesterday that happened that I had to jump on the management call with them. And I had to express to them a concept that we have learned from the Navy SEALs, which is commander's intent, right? So my sole job now is to tell people, this is how I want the battlefield to look after we leave it. That's
right.
It.
Right.
It is their job to do that. Doesn't matter how good the plan is. Once the bullets start flying, everybody's out for themselves. But we now go through that sort of activity on a frequent basis. And then it frees me up from the minutiae and from a lot of things that I don't add value to when I touch. It frees me up from those so that I can only focus on the things that we do add value to. So I'm out there renegotiating a lot of our carrier contracts, a lot of our compensation, redoing a lot of the recruiting intake and, you know, those things that no one really has time to dedicate and get really right. Now that becomes my job. And so my my clock in time in the office is probably 4 hours a week. Of course, I do a lot more work on behalf of the business, but yeah, it's about 4 hours of sort of FaceTime and things that I have to do. And then, you know, you're the owner, so you're available 24/7, but I've got a really good team doing that. I've got, four national figures running that business
now. That's great. Well, I used to always say that a CEO's job is to make sure that they've got the system, the structure, the right people, and the processes set up, and then let everyone else do the cooking. You know, get out of the kitchen, get out of, we used to do an exercise where you draw an org chart and you put all these positions and functions and then circle every single one that you're touching on a frequent basis, and then make a plan to get out of those boxes, like one a quarter, one a month, exactly, as fast as you can. And so that is something you have done really well, it sounds like, and you have a lot of experience. And now you have a book that you've written called A CEO Only Does Three Things. So yes. I was thinking it might be system, structure, people, processes, or something like that. And it says the subtitle is Finding Your Focus in the C-Suite. So tell us a little bit about your book. Maybe tell us some of the key takeaways.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and thanks for asking for that. So we just published a book about 4 weeks ago, doing very well on the launch. Super pleased with how that looks. I wrote the book. The triggering event was I was at a conference, and I swear I don't remember the speaker's name, and it's the only thing I remember from the conference. The speaker said, "Your only moral imperative is to be who you needed when you were younger." And it hit me. It sat on my shoulders for 2 years. And I finally said, you know, the person that I need to be is evident. And I try to be that person today. But what I really needed when I took that job on February the 15th was some sort of guide to figure out what I was supposed to do, because the CEO's position is the only one in the organization without a job description.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
It's the catch-all position. It's the Harry Truman, the buck stops here mentality, which we have perverted down into, an unlimited to-do list for the guy at the top of the organization.
Which is a huge mistake, right? Because I mean,
tremendous mistake.
Yeah. And if you're running a small business and you're listening to this, you know, that catch-all position means that if you're really worth, let's say, $200 an hour or $1,000 an hour, whatever that is, and you're doing stuff that's way beneath that. I used to say, like, if you're a $200 an hour guy and you're doing $25 an hour work, you're stealing $175 for every hour that you're doing that work. And you're stealing from the company, or you're stealing from yourself, which means you're just putting in extra time, which is typical. You know, the average small business owner, he probably works, or she, you know, 60, 80, 100 hours a week because they're doing all those little, you know, nitty gritty things. And that's not exactly what a CEO should be doing. They should have a giant not to do list, and they should be figuring out who to give that not to do list to.
And in your example, mm-hmm. You know, of the 175 and 25, I would submit it's probably $200 of theft, because even though the CEO is doing it, he's probably still paying someone the 25 an hour right. so that he does their position.
Right.
I have a client, their business, you know, multi-generation business. They do about $35 million a year. I was in his office one day. We were presenting his health renewal to him. He gets a call on the phone. He gets up and he disappears. We wait for 45 minutes and I get hot about it. And I finally storm out onto the production floor where I'm not supposed to be. And he is flat of his back underneath one of the production lines, surrounded by five maintenance guys who are sort of cheering him on, you know, to get this thing fixed. And we left. And that afternoon he called me and he was a little bit peeved, you know, that he was the customer, but I had left. And I said, listen, I'm not paid enough to watch you pay five guys to sit around and do something that you're paying them to do. And, you know, that you're no better at than they are, while we've got real business to transact. So no hard feelings, but, you know, I'm not going to sit around for that. Right. And I see that kind of stuff in clients constantly. I have another client who's
famously read your book by now.
He was one of the first ones to get a copy of that book.
All right.
He was with me the whole time. He's actually a board member of mine, so we're close friends as well. Oh, I have another client who's famously ridiculed for insisting on picking the coffee creamer flavor in the break room.
Right.
Yeah, this is a really high functioning executive task, isn't
right.
it?
Right. That's what's up with that, right?
Yeah. And we're all guilty of it. And again, why is that?
Yeah.
To your point, we don't have that not to do list.
Right.
And so the book is all about what is the job description for the CEO and how do you do those things first and make sure the other things are done by other people? And what are those things that help us find our focus? It's my submission that a CEO only does three things: culture, people, and numbers. And mm-hmm. really what I mean by that is he or she sets the agenda around those three topics, because he or she has the perspective and the visibility into all parts of the organization in a way that no one else does. So in other words, you have to do that job because no one else can do that job. No one else can see what you see every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And so we coach our clients through that process. But the number one takeaway is we have a little printed thing that you can get from any printer that says Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, culture, people, numbers.
Right.
What do you do today to action something in your culture, to do something for your people, you know, to improve your numbers in some form or fashion? Right. How do we do that every day? And if I can get clients doing that,
yep.
20 or 30 minutes in the morning, every morning,
yep.
The other stuff is still going to hit the to-do list,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
And we teach delegation, right. automation, outsourcing. We teach those things, of course. But if I can get you touching the future state in the present state every day,
yep.
then you're going to move that ball 1 yard at a time.
Yep.
And at the end of a 10, 15, 25 year career, you'll be so much further along than people who are constantly mired in the to-do list of the day. So that was a super long answer. I apologize for that.
No, but I 100% agree. I mean, I probably would have taken culture and people and sort of combined them because I think that vision is what leaders and CEOs are looked up to do and bring. And so many clients that I've worked with, they don't have a strong vision, and it's because they're so mired in the day-to-day details. If they would focus on the culture, the people, and the numbers, the vision would come out from that, and the
right.
story of where are we going and why are we doing this? And you know, I mean, the culture is about our purpose, right? It's about our values. It's
values, yeah.
the glue that keeps us together. And so one of the tenets of my book, Disruptive Successor, which came out at the same time as your book, mm-hmm. Is that the disruptor needs to find their purpose. And they have to do a lot of soul searching and deep digging, because it isn't the purpose of the father, the founder, the mother, whoever it was, that, you know, the predecessor. It's a different purpose now. And it's that Marshall Goldsmith concept, you know, what got you here isn't going to get you there. So yeah. If you're running a $5 million company and you're a disruptor and you want it to 10X, the business wanted to be a $50 million company, you're going to have to get a whole different purpose. Your BHAG, you're going to have to think in terms of a BHAG or a, you know, 3-year highly achievable goal. And that probably didn't exist in the $5 million company. So
very good point. And, you know, there's a lot of psychological work to be done there. So when I took over the company, I made a promise to myself for the first year as I was learning things, not to change anything at all.
Right.
Just run the business that my dad had run. Just pretend he's on vacation for a while and run the business the way he had run it, so that I could learn exactly what the baseline was, what the benchmarks was. And I couldn't argue with the success of the business. It wasn't like I was taking something over that was in the trash can. Sure. It was on an arc. It was doing very well. 30% growth a year in an industry where 2% growth is considered adequate, you know? Yeah. So I didn't want to come in and reinvent the wheel and then trash the place. But I also realized that I had some skills that I could bring into the business that could probably increase, you know, what we were doing and the upshot of how we did it, and probably spend less in a more targeted way and those kinds of things. The head trash that I had to get through was that changing my dad's business was something that my dad would have wanted me to do.
Ah, interesting.
There was a true belief barrier that I was being disrespectful to him if my business was more successful than his.
Okay, so folks, listen to this point that Trey's making, which is that there's an underlying psychological rivalry that exists between a father and a son, that if the son breaks through that barrier, that somehow he's disrespecting it. Now, take what I just said and put that into a different culture. Put it into an Asian culture, an honor culture, where you're supposed to respect your father. Like, now, is that respect to break through that barrier and you know, and grow it to a whole other dimension? Or is that honor? So that's a very interesting thing. And I can imagine that you'd have a lot of psychological head trash and you'd need a really big cup of coffee to have that conversation.
Yeah. And so I think I struggled with that for 2 or 3 years. And I had a mentor, Ron Willingham, you probably know his name. He sold millions of books and lost him last year as well, as a matter of fact. But, you know, a tremendous mentor to me who really helped me walk the path of understanding that there's no way that my dad invested in me in the way that he did so that I would be less than he did, than he was,
right.
So that I would be unhappy, so that I would be unfulfilled in my life. Because as fathers, that's not what we want for our children.
No, we want our kids to be happy. We want them to be successful.
That's right.
We want to be proud of them.
We want them to exceed us in every measure in life.
100%. You know? Which is a problem, by the way, in multi-generational businesses where I'm sorry, folks, that are using the old man kind of concept, because most businesses are founded and run by men still. But if the old man is 80, 85, he's still showing up to work every day and he's still kind of ruling with a strong thumb that, like, this is, you know, this is my business, we'll do it my way. I mean, that's a problem. And talking to a fellow colleague, they call that in England, the sticky baton syndrome, where the father has trouble letting go of the baton, they call it, and passing it to the next generation. So interesting.
Very interesting. I have a friend who described, he's in that situation where he was taking over from his father, and his father was 80 years old. You know, they made the title shift. They did all of the trappings, but every day, you know, somebody would come in and ask dad what he wanted done in the business.
Right.
And dad was a World War II buff, loved him all the time for 40 years, read World War II books and nothing else. And he was a huge fan of Rommel. Mm-hmm. And Rommel, and I couldn't say it in German if I tried, but there's a term in German that means fingertip feel, where you can put your fingers on something and you can feel the very minute differences in texture and that sort of thing. And Rommel would use that to say, I understand the battle in such a way that I can feel every little nuance on the battlefield, and that's how I win. And the father eventually told the son, the older you get, the less fingertip feel you have. And so the less precise the movements are that you need to make.
Right.
And I am not able to tell these people who have been my compatriots for 40 years that I can't do it anymore. And you have to do that for us now. And so that was the process that they worked through. What I like about it is we all find our own idiom, you know, and that was what he needed to really back out of the office. And so now I think he only comes in 3 days a week instead of 5 days.
You know? God, well, that's a good thing. So, all right. So now let's turn the conversation around to angel investing. You've written this book. I'm sure it's a book that you want to get in the hands of every single company that you've invested in, and you want them to understand what the CEO's role is. And you're probably, I imagine, providing some mentoring along with that smart money, right? It's not just money; it's smart money because you're providing mentoring. So I'd imagine your angel, the investees, if that's a word, are younger people, millennials, probably by and large, 25 to 40, maybe even younger. I don't know.
They didn't used to be younger than me,
right?
But they are now. Yeah,
exactly. And so, what are the challenges in investing in these companies? And, you know, are you facing that some people have hubris and they think that they know it all, and they're like, you know, well, what have you done? I mean, and maybe they size you up like you're running an insurance company. Like, I mean, so tell us a little bit about your experience with angel investing, maybe how you find companies and how you invest in them.
Yeah, so I had great mentorship when it came to venture capital investments, and we've had a stunning track record that I take no credit for, because it was just the principles that I apply. Number one is you bet the jockey, not the horse.
Right.
So it's so easy to fall in love with a product and say, God, I would use that product every day of the week. You know, focus group of one.
Yep.
If I do it, 300 million people will do it. That math never plays out. And I passed on things, you know, where I wouldn't have anything to do with it, and then find out later that it's wildly successful because everybody else saw something I didn't see, you know? And, so you can't focus group of one on that, and you have to really focus on who the person running the company is.
Yeah.
Part of the challenge is that largely the person who can take the risk is usually younger without a lot of,
mortgage
experience
and they don't
right. have a lot of obligations, you know,
right.
And so that creates in them a different trajectory in mm-hmm. what they can do. And so you put your thumb on it. Exactly. I don't care. The CEO still has to do the same three things, no matter if he's in a 4-man company or he's in a 60,000 man company. It doesn't matter. Those three things still have to be done by the CEO because they can't be done anywhere else. And so we have a planning model. When I was in the VC business before, we were called in by a lot of lead investors after 9/11 to say, can you go in and figure out which of these companies we need to continue funding? Because we can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a process that we put into place that now has become my planning process that I work with clients on. Mm-hmm. Every single one of my angel investments, we go through that planning process where we touch 10 areas of the business and set 1-year strategic action goals. They set the goals. I facilitate that. And then I worked with the CEOs. Now I have a book to hand them, but very often I have just had mentorship sessions where I've said, I know that you cannot push pause on everything going on, but I'm pushing pause and pulling you out to focus on recruiting efforts today, or retention efforts, or some cultural exercise, or some numbers-based exercise that won't pay off this year. It'll pay off in 3 years, and that sort of thing. And to a man or a woman, they have all come back later and said, that was some of the most valuable work that I did as CEO, meaning that was something that added more dollar signs and more, comma points to the value of the business than the other stuff that we were doing, which we would have done anyway. You can't have a company where you don't build product. Or where you don't build sales. They're going to do that anyway. But forcing someone to sort of take that soft time and pull back and say, let me think about things from a 30,000 foot perspective, on a regular basis is something that increases the value of I would submit any company.
Absolutely any company. And so my listeners are mostly family businesses and next generation leaders in those family businesses, and they need to do those same three things. Focus on, well, vision maybe to start with, but people, culture, and numbers, and take that 30,000 foot view, because, you know, again, what got you here is not going to get you there. So the family business, the product or service, the way it's being delivered, the processes that you use to actually operate the business. So, you know, the technology that's available to us today that we can implement into our businesses to make things faster, better, you know, quicker, smarter. Like, we need to embrace those things. And so we have to be thinking like a disruptor to be able to improve the business. I've always said, because someone once said, a mentor once said this to me, he says, John, like, my business, you have to reinvent yourself every 3 to 5 years. And as someone who's been coaching since 2004 and consulting small businesses since 1987, I have literally had to reinvent my business and the businesses that I ran every 3 to 5 years, because I get stale, because I have to make it interesting. If you had told me 5 years ago that I would be doing podcasts and writing a book, I would have said, nah, I don't think so. But it's really where I get most of my pleasure and joy from, as well as coaching the clients. But look, these are great lessons. And whether you're an angel investor, an angel entrepreneur who is trying to scale up the business, or you're taking over a family business, you still need to focus on those three things. I couldn't agree with you more. So
yeah, great.
Fantastic. Hey, this has been a great conversation, Trey. You are a man of many talents, and you are no small town Georgian guy. So I'm super impressed with your go for itness, and just the things that you've accomplished. I really look forward to reading your book and sharing it with others. Any final thoughts, things that you want to share with people?
No, I want to thank you for the work that you do with this transition period, because it is the hardest piece of, you know, running multi-generational businesses. How do you get, you know, one to the other? And then how do you let that, you know, next generation handle things? So many businesses go down the tubes because they don't get that right. It may not be this immediate flashpoint, but it, you know, it can be a very difficult transition. And I'm so glad that somebody is doing that. I see quite a lot of businesses in my own orbit where they struggle with that. And so I'm so thankful that somebody's taken a look at that.
Well, thanks for the acknowledgement. I mean, family businesses need a playbook as well. You know, just like we're familiar with the scaling up playbooks, we're both fans of Vern Harnish and friends, who's written the Scaling Up, which is literally a playbook for mid-market entrepreneurs that are trying to 10x their companies or 5x them and are already in the middle market space or are ascending that direction. But they also need someone who, I think this is my special skill set, who is almost like a family therapist, like a psychologist, who can have the conversation confidentially with the predecessor and then with the successor, and can play in the spaces in between those people. And if there's too much conflict, can sort of sort through that conflict. Or if there's not enough conflict, which is the opposite problem, which is we see in so many businesses, you know, everyone just sort of quietly gets along, but there's an earthquake underneath the surface, you know, there. And so playing in those spaces in between, I feel, is a special skill. And having a roadmap, knowing the three things to focus on, having books like what we're writing, I think are great guides for everyone. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if I were going through it, I would definitely want to reach out to somebody who has seen multiple interactions of these things, multiple iterations of these things, I should say, because, you know, in my lifetime, how many times am I going to transition a business to the next generation? Once, by definition, once, right?
Exactly.
And you hope not twice. I hope I'm not 88 doing it, you know, down to another generation as well. So I would really want somebody to be there with me who said, no, 12 out of 15 times, this is what happens. And we're going to know about that way in advance. And we're going to map around that and we're going to execute to a different result. That would be so helpful. So again, just so pleased with that work that you do.
Okay, great. So now one other question, which is, do you have a succession plan in place for Taylor Insurance Services?
So we have a, I will fumble on this because obviously my plans have changed greatly in the past 12 months.
Okay.
So our previous plan was that if something were to happen with me, my brother would come back in and run the business
sure.
in trust for the next generation. Now we are doing that in such a way that potentially for the first time in three generations, we would have outside owners come in, meaning okay. our managers.
Right.
Would achieve an ownership structure. Yeah.
So, are we looking at an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, which is kind of complicated, but
I think we would, you know, the principles of having employees own yep. part of the company that they work with, but we're not getting into the complicated nature of running an ESOP. ESOPs are right. extraordinarily difficult
totally,
to
absolutely.
Comply with. Yeah.
100%.
But the idea might be for us to say, look, we have these four general managers. Why don't you guys buy in at a certain level? It's the law firm model, right? Yep. Buy a partnership yep. in what we're doing.
Yep.
Yeah. So those conversations will kick off in January of next year, as a matter of fact.
And that's great. And I suppose that a lot of businesses don't make it to the next generation because life happens. And things happen, and then suddenly now you're faced with having to make decisions that you hadn't thought about. So, you know,
we all think we have more time to make yep. these decisions than we do?
Yes, we're immortal. Yeah. We're never going to die, and we don't need to work through these things, and I'll deal with it later. And, you know, so I'm glad to hear that you're thinking through that. And so, well, it's been a great hour together. Really enjoyed it. Yeah. So, Trey, how can people get a hold of you?
So they can find the book on Amazon.
Okay.
A CEO only does three things.
Right.
So they can find that there. And again, doing very well. Appreciate any of the support that people can give to the book so that it can get out to a wider audience. And then our consulting firm where we come in and help companies, sort of design processes and systems around supporting what the CEO's vision for the business is trinityblue.com. Trinity-blue.com is the name of the consulting company.
Super. Fantastic. Awesome. All right. Well, folks, this is Jonathan Goldhill signing out another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And if you liked this show, please pass it along, share it with others, subscribe, and we'll see you on the next episode. Thanks. Bye now.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.